You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Screens of the Stone Age, the podcast where scientists review movies about prehistoric people. I'm Dr. Joshua Lindell. I am a paleoanthropologist studying Neanderthals, and I'm here with...
I'm Dr. Kimberly Plonk. I am a bioarchaeologist. I study the human skeleton, health and disease, and evolution.
And I'm Dr. Ross Barnett, interested in ancient DNA and phylogenetics of the Ice Age.
And today you get to listen to three white people review the rap album from another white guy. Oh, I should say Happy New Year, everybody. This is our first episode of 2026.
Oh, still feels like 2025.
Yeah.
It is still November of 2025 as we're recording this. We're getting a big head start on our recording, which is unusual for us. We're usually putting things off to the last minute, but we are almost like professional podcasters now.
Yeah.
Today we are reviewing The Rap Guide to Evolution, which is a music album by an artist named Baba Brinkman. I think you guys watched the YouTube playlist that I linked in the email, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
So this is a playlist from his channel. It's not the complete album, because I think the complete album has about 13 or 14 songs. This playlist had only 10 songs, and it was a separate playlist because this is the ones that had music videos associated. So we're only reviewing these 10 music videos. But do we want to... How do we want to do this? Want to go one video at a time? We don't really have that much to summarize because they're music videos. They don't really have that much of a narrative, but we can sort of summarize the like core concept of each song, I guess, one at a time as we go through them.
I mean, that's how I took notes is on kind of each video.
We should say, too, that they're funded by the Wellcome Trust. So it was a Wellcome Trust public engagement grant that funded the videos.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, we could do a little bit of background on the whole concept. So this all sort of came out around 2012, which was, what was the deal? It was the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth. Does that make sense? That doesn't make sense. What was the deal with 2012? It was something special for Darwin.
Wasn't it 150 years since... Was it 150 years since natural selection?
2009 would have been, yeah.
Then I don't know.
Born in 1809, died 1882, species published 1859.
So it's not 2012, it's 2009 that I'm thinking of, which would have been 200 years since Darwin's birth and 150 years since origin. And I guess the videos come out a little later, but I think it was on 2009. The story is that some biologist gave a challenge to Baba Brinkman because this guy had hard to find the exact details of his education. Wikipedia says that he has a master's degree. He has a bachelor's from Simon Fraser. Kim, that's where you
did my postdocs.
Were working. Did your postdocs. He's Canadian. He did his undergrad at Simon Fraser, and Wikipedia says he did a master's at the University of Victoria, I think. I was trying to find his master's thesis, and I couldn't find it anywhere. So elsewhere, he mentions something about his honors thesis, but either way, he did some sort of university project where he rewrote the Canterbury Tales in rap, and he references that in this... series as well. And so after hearing that, some biologist, I can't remember his name, in the UK challenged him to do a rap album about evolution for Darwin's bicentennial. And that's basically what started this whole thing here. So we want to go through the list of songs on the playlist and talk about them one after the other.
Yeah, do it that way.
Our first song is called Performance Feedback Revision. Who wants to tackle the concept of this one?
Yeah, I could do this one. So I really like this one. I think this is one of the stronger ones. It's kind of making the comparison between how you write lyrics for a rap battle or any kind of creative endeavor with how evolution by natural selection works. So you have performance, feedback, revision. That's the loop that that Baba Brinkman goes through for his rap work. He does the rap, he gets feedback, and then he modifies it to make it better so that it works. The flow is tighter and the lyrics are sharper. And that this is essentially what evolution by natural selection boils down to. You have performance, which is your kind of phenotype. You have your feedback, which is the how successfully you produce offspring, your fitness, essentially. And then you have revision, which is how many of your offspring survive to reproduce themselves as well. And that is the eternal loop of evolution, which was really, I think, quite nicely done. Got the point across really succinctly in a pretty cool way. Shouts out to quite a few public intellectuals during the course of the song. So Dan Dennett gets mentioned, Richard Dawkins gets mentioned, talks about a few fossils as well. So we get shout outs to Homo ergaster, Homo erectus, Australopithecus. Sarah Hardy gets a mention as well. Mm-hmm. The only issue I had was that he also talks about Ambulocetus, but he talks about archaeologists digging up Ambulocetus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is like, oh no. Oh no. I mean, this is something we talked about before, so archaeologists do not dig up fossil whales. Archaeologists don't even dig up fossil humans. They just dig up modern humans and modern human stuff. If you're digging up fossil humans, you're a paleoanthropologist or a paleontologist. If you dig up fossil vertebrates, then you're definitely a paleontologist. So that was a bit jarring, considering everything else was pretty good.
That was the first time that made me realize, I was like, oh, okay, he's not an archaeologist or anthropologist. Mm-hmm. Like, he's something else. Yeah,
He's a rapper first and a evolutionary biologist second.
I should at this point give a shout out to my friend Dr. Predrag Radovich, who's been on the show a couple of times. Mm-hmm. We do archaeology together, obviously, like paleoarchaeology of Neanderthals, but he has published several prehistoric whales as well, in addition to lots of prehistoric primates, and I think he's working on publishing the first dinosaurs from Serbia right now as we speak.
That's so he's awesome.
But
so he's
combining.
He's
speaking,
doing paleontology.
His degree is
doing both. So he's living the dream essentially.
Strictly speaking, his PhD is in paleontology, which has been a problem for him because I know he's having trouble getting a job at the archaeology department because he doesn't have the right PhD, and Serbia loves their regulations. Mm. So
I guess he's the exception that proves the rule. That's how we can live.
Uh-huh. He's also a workaholic, so
sounds like it.
Yeah. So yeah, this is pretty cool. I like the rhymes, like the flow. He also slags off Richard Dawkins a little bit, calls him pompous, which I think fairly standard these days. I could maybe mention that when I was a postgrad in Oxford, Richard Dawkins had an office on the same kind of corridor as us, allegedly, though we never saw him. The only time I saw him, I accidentally let the door close in his face, and he didn't look very happy about that. That's my one Dawkins story.
I liked the video of it too. I thought it was fun to watch. Well done.
Yeah.
One thing that he says in this video is, I think he's just referring to evolution. He says, "Evo Devo people found evidence for it up in an
animal's
fetus."
Or they said up in an animal's womb.
I think he said fetus because that's what I have written here. I'm wondering if he's talking about the whole like ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny thing, but he says Evo Devo specifically, which is sort of not that. So do you know exactly what he's referring to there?
So for our listeners, Evo Devo is evolutionary development, right? Evolution and development, evolutionary development.
Yeah.
Yeah. I assumed it was Hegelian kind of ontogeny, phylogeny sort of stuff that he was talking about. Because it is all very kind of broad strokes.
Yeah. I think that's going to be something across our whole episode here, which is that this is rap. It's very dense with words. He says a lot of stuff, and we're going to be sort of picking and choosing one line here and there and trying to deconstruct it. I don't think we'll have a problem having enough to say, but it might be a lot of interpreting what one sentence means here and there.
Yeah.
So yeah, the whole concept that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, or recapitulation theory, is this idea that if you look at an embryo, it kind of looks a little bit like a fish or a worm. And so this is the idea that a fetus has to go through every evolutionary stage from its ancestry before it develops into the adult version, or the version that will be born. And that's not true. That's an old theory that we kind of threw away in like the mid 20th century. And so specifically because he talks about the Evo-Devo people, I feel like Evo-Devo are the people who would be studying this kind of thing. Now they would be the ones who overturned recapitulation theory, probably. So I don't know, maybe we're trying too hard for a single sentence right off the top here.
Yeah, I think we always try too hard, essentially. The whole basis of the
podcast.
I
wish I tried harder for this episode. I have too many things where I didn't have time to go down every research rabbit hole for all the things I wanted to talk about here.
I mean, it could just be as simple as Evo-Devo was something he wanted to throw in, and what did they do? They look at developments. Yeah. He just had a word that rhymed with fetus. I don't remember what it was. Like, it could just be that simple.
Like,
too,
species,
right?
Species, I think, was, or thesis.
Something.
Considering that the literal next line, the thing he's rhyming with fetus, is archaeologists found evidence for it up in Ambulocetus. So,
great. Yeah.
Do we want to move on to the next song, the next video, I'm a African?
This one was so catchy.
Well, this is one of three songs, which is a remix of an existing song, by the way.
Oh, okay. I don't know it.
Let me find the answer for you. I'm not big on hip hop, but this song is by Dead Prez.
Never heard of him.
Okay. Me neither. I think I have, but I'm not sure.
Unless they did an album with Bob Dylan, I wouldn't know. So it's I'm a African, and it's essentially, I think it's really well done in terms of like imagery and stuff. I really liked it. It took me back to like the days when music videos were entertaining and good and artistic. I don't know what they are now, so I'm saying that without having seen one now in decades. But so essentially what it is saying that based on genetics, all humans are African because we all have our shared common ancestry can be linked back to mitochondrial Eve in Africa. And so no matter who we are, where we're living, we're all African. I think that's about it. So it's just kind of that repetitive over and over in different songs, right? It's down to the genetics. We're all one family. We're all related.
What I took away from this is that there's a lot of countries in the world that end in A.
Yes.
At one point, he basically lists and spells them all and rhymes the A with every other A, which is quite funny. But there was there's a nice cameo at the end from Chris Stringer from the Natural History Museum saying, I'm an African, as the kind of
end note. Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, at the end, Chris Stringer himself makes an appearance, which is nice. Obviously, one of the most famous paleoanthropologists, I think, around.
Strong proponent now.
Of the out of Africa hypothesis. So it was nice to get him specifically in for this song. And the idea that we have a kind of mitochondrial ancestor in Africa goes back quite a long way. So some of the very first kind of human phylogenetic works by Luca Cavalli-Sforza back in the late 80s, early 90s, looked at mitochondrial genes from lots and lots of different human groups and found that they all kind of rooted in the diversity of Africa. So the diversity of every non-African human on the planet is less than the diversity you find in many different parts of Africa itself, because we have been through a bottleneck as we kind of came out of the continent, and that has we've not as a group recovered the amounts of diversity that we lost.
Yeah, so that's the out of Africa hypothesis of human origins, which I'm sure we've mentioned before. Archaeological evidence also supports that. So, like, the oldest modern human fossils we have are from Africa. The oldest right now is Jebel Erhoud in Morocco, which is 315,000. But there are a few weird outliers. So there's a fossil from Greece, which is like 200,000, which was recently attributed to modern humans, or recently redated to 200,000, mm-hmm. which is kind of surprising.
I mean, the hypothesis itself doesn't discount the fact that there may have been previous emigrations from Africa, just that they haven't left any lasting signature in the genetics of modern populations, which is what all mm-hmm. the DNA sort of seems to say. And there is a little bit, I mean, it's changed from a complete replacement to mostly replacement, but with some interbreeding. So that's why non-African humans have a significant percentage of Neanderthal DNA or Denisovan DNA or potentially DNA from other groups as well. Because despite us all descending from a group that kind of left Africa 180,000 years ago, there were other humans around that we interbred with, and that has left a legacy in our genetic signature as well.
Mm-hmm. When I teach this, I call it the mostly out of Africa model, because out of Africa still stands, but we have a little bit of multi-regionalism mixed into it.
Yeah, well, it's kind of that classic thing, these two debates that people fought for decades, one or the other, and then you find out that it's a mix, right? But
yeah,
it's not as simple as either direction.
It's classic Thomas Kuhn kind of thesis, antithesis, synthesis kind of scientific philosophy working together kind of thing. Everyone's a little bit right in the end.
Yep.
So this video is about the out of Africa hypothesis. Everything it says is fine. It's a good message. We are all humans. We all trace our ancestry to a common ancestor in Africa. But how do we feel cringy at all that this is a white guy singing "I'm an African"?
was a bit like, I was like, is this okay though? Right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And then a lot of the people in it, I understand that he probably was like, I think he records it using people in his life, right?
It feels like it, yeah.
Like family and stuff. But like, a lot of the people are in there are white.
Yeah. I felt it was a bit cringe.
Yeah. It's catchy though. And the video is well done. But yeah, I think he probably could have done like maybe a different title and tagline, like instead of "I'm an African," something else. I don't know.
Well, like I said, this is one of three songs on this album that are remixes of existing songs. So the existing song is called "I'm an African." The refrain is the same from that. He basically, when he started writing the album, went through his record collection to find any songs that already might have some sort of evolutionary inkling to it. And he basically took the song and he's like, "Oh, I'm an African. This is out of Africa." He can rewrite this to be about out of Africa. And so, like, that, all that catchy part is not his. That's the dead prez for you.
Great. Maybe I like them.
Or dead, not the dead prez. We're going to be so white in this episode for anybody listening, but I'm sorry
about
that.
Other thing is, too, is, like, you can't, we shouldn't necessarily want him to just jump over that entire aspect of human evolution just because he's white either, right?
Sure.
But I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. Find another way of doing it.
Do we want to move on to our next track?
I think we should.
Yeah, you cover this one, Josh.
Oh, great. This one. This one is called "Creationist Cousins." This one's pretty catchy. This one's a little different from his other videos because most of them are sort of lots of graphics splashing around the screen. This is mostly him playing multiple roles as all of his family members, who are mostly creationists, sitting around the dinner table. And he's talking about the discussions that he has with his creationist family. And I don't know about you guys, but I feel like this whole evolution versus creation debate kind of hit its peak around this time. And this isn't something that we talk about too much anymore, because I feel like we've moved on to stupider anti-science.
Yeah, we've got dumber.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can't worry about human evolution anymore. We have to worry about whether the earth is round or whether you should be taking horse medicine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whether windmills cause cancer.
Yeah, the Overton windows moved significantly in the debate. And so, you know, we're kind of hankering back to the highfalutin conversations we used to have with people who actually understood at least that there were different species that and fossils and stuff. I mean, that's the golden days now.
Well, I mean, the creationist stuff that he talks about here is stuff that we've talked about a lot. Like, if we came from monkeys, then why are there still monkeys? That kind of thing. The thing that I really found interesting here is when he gets into the conversation with his sister, who he doesn't paint in a very good light, but his sister seems to be university educated.
Yeah.
And she's talking about, he uses the term cultural creationism, aka social constructivism. And his sister says there's a tribe in the Amazon where the women do the men's roles. And I don't remember the study specifically, but I read about it in my women and gender studies class, so I know it's real. And he's pretty dismissive of that. It sounds like she's having a real academic discussion with him, and he's being pretty dismissive of it.
Mm. I did not like the face he made to the camera with that.
That made me so angry. And so I had to look up social constructivism, and I think that calling it cultural creationism, I think he's calling it cultural creationism, and obviously by calling it creationism, he is being dismissive of it, because in biology, he's doing a biology album. Creationism, of course, is antithetical to that. So by calling it cultural creationism, he is putting it in the same group as religious creationists.
But the thing is, it just really kind of pissed me off, because one, what her spiel had nothing to do with what the rest of the song was about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that she said weren't necessarily wrong. She said some wrong things, right? Like that science is a social construct. But I guess the way that we do science and the way that we perform science is a social construct. It's just the results are not a social construct, right? Mm-hmm. But gender is a social construct. Things like that are changeable. Like, things that she said weren't wrong, and then he just does that side look to the camera like, oh, feminism.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I got from it as well, that it didn't have much to do with the rest of the good points he was making. It was just him kind of sort of shouting out to the dude bros that would play well with.
Yeah, and conflating creationism with this. If he had gone, at first I thought maybe he was mixing it up, the social constructivism or whatever, with biological determinism. Maybe I thought he had mistaken that. But then when I listened more, I was like, that's not what that's about either. So I don't know.
So neither of you have heard of social constructivism before?
No. He talks about postmodernism as well, which obviously I have heard of.
Yeah, and he brings this up in another video too. So I think he brings it up in the next video, where he has Michel Foucault as a bad guy against Darwin somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it didn't really, it sort of was a bit cringe and didn't really do him any favors. But then at the same time, he was also putting across the fair point that, you know, nobody's impartial. So this is obviously his blind spot coming through. Whether he's doing that deliberately or not, I don't know. But yeah, I think there's plenty to criticize there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's a quote from the Wikipedia page for social constructivism, which is not to be mistaken with social constructionism, which is a whole separate field. But this is under the philosophy section of social constructivism. It says, strong social constructivism as a philosophical approach tends to suggest that, quote, the natural world has a small or non-existent role in the construction of scientific knowledge, end quote. I don't know whose quote that is, though. But basically, I think the argument his sister is making is that scientific knowledge is like a super postmodern view, I guess, that scientific knowledge is not actually any more objectively true about the universe than anything else. It's also a socially constructed knowledge system, just like any other knowledge system. And I mean, I had such a hard time wrapping my head around postmodernism when I was in undergrad, and I've since come to really like this kind of, you know, philosophical discussion. I think obviously the extreme view that all knowledge is completely subjective and there's no objective truth that you get from postmodernism is, you know, too much. But I do think that these sort of conversations about how much of science is as objective as we say it is, like to be able to criticize science from sort of an outside perspective and assess how much of our knowledge really is as objective as we really think it is a important thing to do in science.
But I mean,
yeah, but I mean, a lot of that's going to be our interpretations are not, our interpretations are going to be biased, but the results, the data are not necessarily, right?
Unless it also becomes a bit of a paradox, I think. That, you know, if you have like a postmodern or constructivist take on science, then why is that take more impartial than any other? You're sort of you end up with a kind of self contradiction that you can't accuse other knowledge systems of being impartial if then as part of your thesis you would have to be impartial as well. Or you can't be you can't be objective if part of your thesis is that nothing is objective. So
yes,
you know, either everything is or everything isn't. You kind of tie yourself in knots that way. And it's a different kind of conversation. It's more philosophical one than like creation versus evolution, which is, you know, fact based. Like you can argue philosophically and still you know, come up with great ideas, but they're just not testable really in a way because you're talking about such kind of big ideas that they're not testable. I mean that's just philosophy for the most part, or certainly the philosophy of ideas, they're not testable. But because I mean I'm getting kind of tied in knots myself here, but you can't get outside of them, essentially. You can't be external to these ideas.
The idea that knowledge has to be testable to be valid is a scientific social construct, and it's a social construct of science. So that's only true if you're in a scientific worldview.
Science is always going to be through the lens of humans, which is always going to be faulty at some degree. But some things are way more faulty than other things, right?
Yeah.
And Tim mentions this in his song Storm. It's like, yeah, so all knowledge is a construct, all, you know, it's all subjective, but it's not at the same level. Like, you know, you can make a decision about something, but you're not going to walk out through your second story window instead of using the door, because the knowledge that you have about gravity and distance and velocity of you hitting the cement is subjective. Right? Like there's things that are more objective than others, even though, yes, we are still humans and things are going to be flawed, right?
I guess it comes down to that CP Box quote that, you know, all models are wrong, but some are useful. And that's what you're saying, Kim, is that it doesn't really matter whether you subscribe to the Ptolemaic system or the Copernican system, you're still going to see the sunrise in the morning and set in the evening.
Yeah,
you know, that's the fact of the matter. It doesn't matter which way you explain that, the facts are still going to be there.
Yes.
Well, I don't feel like I have a good sense of what social constructivism actually is based on reading a few paragraphs on Wikipedia. So I have no idea if this conversation is in any way relevant. If anybody's listening and understands social constructivism, send us an email and let us know what it actually is. Do we want to move on to the next video, which is natural selection?
This one doesn't really say anything, though. Really?
What? Yeah, in terms of the song,
rap battle.
Yeah, the song was great. I thought it was the best one, and I think it did have something to say in terms of using the analogy of sort of subgenres of music as a kind of mutations that can then be selected on. I thought that was quite cool. I hadn't seen that sort of explained that way before, even if it is slightly Lamarckian rather than Darwinian in terms of the way it would work, but it's a nice idea and it gets the idea across. And there were some good lines about the weak and the strong, whoever leaves the most spawn That was quite a good line. Also, they kind of went into quite a bit of depth later on in the song about the difference between, you know, people who say they believe in creationism or they believe in evolution, and that's not really what it is. It's about understanding and perceiving things rather than believing.
Well, yeah, I actually wrote down this line too, because this is something that certainly I always sort of believed, you know, in the past, that nobody believes in evolution. You either understand it or you don't. And so there's sort of two angles to look at this. First of all, I think that, do you think it's true that anybody who, no, sorry, I gotta frame this the right way. I think that nobody who doesn't believe in evolution understands it. Right. I don't think that there's anybody who understands in evolution and still doesn't believe it. And I think there are a lot of people who believe in evolution that don't understand it. Right.
So I think that there's a lot of people who might actually kind of understand evolution, but they put up those guardrails because they need to believe in religion. So they do kind of understand it, but they're just going to, like, whatever that, you know, the horses with the
blinders
on. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, they're just gonna be like, nope, never mind, doesn't matter, just never think about it. If you never open that box, you don't have to face it. So I think there's those people too.
I would sort of agree and disagree. So I think certainly that let me just think back to the way that Josh phrased it, so I can get it right.
The perfectly clear way that I phrased it.
I think there certainly are people that believe in evolution but don't understand it. They've just sort of ticked the box and said, yeah, it works for me. I think all these other things are nonsense. I don't have to worry about it. I'm just going to say, yes, I do. And I don't have to think about it any further. And that's true for, I'm sure, a majority of people.
I don't understand how my phone works, but I trust the people that put it together.
Exactly.
Right? Like, you just...
I think there's possibly more nuance with the opposite, that I think there probably are people that understand evolution but don't believe in it. And whether that's because they come at it from a theistic evolution point of view, that they think it's directed, they can still understand, you know, the kind of intricacies of genetic drift or a positive selection, things like that, but still think that there's an underlying hand of a creator there somewhere. And that's fine. I mean, I don't have a problem with that at all.
But then that's still evolution. It's just that they believe that it's being helped, right?
Yeah.
So they're not creationalist, really.
Yeah, I guess. But again, we get into sort of the semantics of what do we mean by understand.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I think the majority of people that don't believe in evolution also don't understand it as well. But there are certainly... I mean, it's tricky because, as many people have said, you know, starting with Thomas Huxley, is that it's such an obvious idea once you kind of get a handle on it. It only requires three things to be inevitable, which he talks about in his first song, that you have to have mutations. So you have to have random changes. We can see that happens. Everyone's slightly different. That's because they have differences about them. Not everyone or not everything survives to produce offspring. Things die by accident, by being hunted, being preyed upon. That's also true in humans as well. I mean, there's been stories just this week in Canada about people getting mauled by bears. So, you know, we're not outside of of the food chain. Yeah, do you not hear that?
No.
I did not hear that.
No? There was a whole school.
Near me?
I don't know. I mean, Canada's quite a small place, so I imagine it would be.
I just hope they didn't hurt the bear.
Yeah, I think there's a whole school class that just got mauled by a bear. Anyway.
In British Columbia, that's your area, Kim.
It.
That's the second thing. And then the third thing is that your offspring has to inherit some of your characteristics. And we can see that intuitively as well, that, you know, siblings look alike and they look like their parents. There is inheritance involved. So if you have just those three things, then evolution by natural selection is inevitable. And that's all you have to understand. Mm-hmm. Where it becomes complicated is then people sort of argue about length of time, you know, whether it can be directed or undirected, all these kind of things. But the actual understanding doesn't take a lot of brain power.
So I'm thinking about this this idea from an education or outreach sort of perspective, right? So, like, around the time this came out, like late 2000s, like 2009 to 2012 is when I would have been probably hearing about this album for the first time. That was like my transition from undergrad to grad school, probably like my like peak like edgelord atheist pro-science kind of phase, right?
Yeah.
And I think that that's where sort of internet culture was at the time. I think that that was sort of a real common thing, because you got Dawkins and, you know, other people doing stuff on the internet at the time.
That was peak Dawkins as well.
Peak Dawkins, yeah. So I feel like at the time, my feeling on the matter probably would have been, people don't understand evolution. If you understand it, if you understand how the mechanism works, it's impossible not to believe it. And so the problem is that people just don't have the education. They don't have the facts. If they had the facts, they'd have to believe it. And of course, I've since learned, because I got way more into science education and outreach, I've since learned that's not how people understand anything. You have to reach people emotionally. And so it's not that people don't understand evolution, that they don't believe it. It's that they have a worldview where they've been taught that evolution doesn't fit. And so this idea that nobody believes in evolution, you either understand it or you don't, I think we've sort of come to this understanding right now that there are people who believe in evolution who don't understand it, and there are people who don't believe in evolution who probably do understand it at least a little bit. And whether or not you understand it probably doesn't have that much bearing on whether or not you believe it. And if we want, from an education or outreach perspective, if we want to get people to believe in evolution, we can't just teach them facts. We have to reach out emotionally and figure out, what is it about your worldview that isn't allowing you to believe in evolution, and sort of, you know, work at reconstructing a worldview and dealing with like emotion rather than just facts, right?
Yeah. And that certainly, that wasn't a message that was very loud between 2009 and 2012. Feelings were not for the people that were involved with this kind of outreach. So it's nice that we moved on.
Well, we're already at 40 minutes in our recording, and I think that we have done
the next couple will be pretty videos. Quick, though, I think.
Okay.
Like the next one, I'll do the next one. I have no idea what it was about. Sexual selection, I think.
Yeah, it was about sexual selection.
He just wanted to get a bunch of beautiful women to rub up on him.
But Kim, you know this song, right? This song was Hypnotize.
Yeah, yeah. This is the big guy. Biggie Big.
Notorious B.I.G.
Yeah, right? Hypnotize me. Yeah, so I think he's just essentially saying, so he gets some beautiful female scientist, puts a bunch of wires on his head and shows him, like, they're doing like a functional MRI type of idea where they're looking at brain activity as he's watching videos, and for some reason also like daydreaming about the videos happening to him. So these beautiful women rubbing up on him, dancing around him like he's in the music video, and then throws in some comparisons to birds and like peacocking and stuff like that. For how males generally try to impress the ladies for reproductive purposes. But yeah, I didn't really like this one. It didn't really say much.
Yeah, it's about, this video is just about sexual selection. What he's doing is he's drawing a comparison between like the bling in hip hop culture and like peacock's tail, sexual selection kind of stuff. He's also doing, drawing a connection to not just the physical bling, but I think he talks about his like lyrical bling. Like he's attractive to women because of the words. Yeah. Because of his lyricism.
Of his big brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think this is where we start to get a hint of the sort of biological reductionism sort of at the heart of this, which I think sort of ties into what we talked about in the last one, where during this time, it's very hard science, not a lot of room for emotion, for wishy-washiness. And I think, I don't know if we don't have too much more. Ross, if you've got anything more to say about Hypnotize.
No, I just thought that there was some quite cool bits in it. So like his sort of take-home message was that the best displays are unfakeable, which is definitely something that I think most biologists would agree with, that he kind of makes the case that, you know, a lot of human society and a lot of creative endeavors are equivalent to peacock tail, whether that's rapping or drawing or whatever, or accumulating wealth. That these are all examples of peacocking, but some of them can be faked and some of them can't. You can certainly, you can buy fake gold chains, but you can't fake a good rap, I guess, would be maybe his take home message.
Mm. Yeah, I didn't get that.
Fair enough.
Well, our next video is Survival of the Fittest, and this one also is a remix of a song called Survival of the Fittest by Mobb Deep. And again, so this one is about Survival of the Fittest is about like senseless violence. And he has taken it and turned it around to say maybe this violence isn't so senseless. Maybe this violence is an evolutionary adaptation. And at the beginning of this one, he says, I'm sending this out to my evolutionary psychology people. And he lists a bunch of evolutionary psychologists. How do we all feel about evolutionary psychology in the year 2026?
I like it, but I think you have to be careful with it.
Yeah.
It's a lot of cool ideas, but not an awful lot of testing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if there's any way to test it. I think it's just kind of cool ideas and setting things into frameworks,
but,
I suppose.
But testing, as we established, is just a social construct as part of the scientific worldview.
Yeah. But I mean, like, you know, if you take say anxiety and put it through an evolutionary medicine lens, right? You can start to understand why people nowadays have such problems with anxiety. It's because for a lot of our existence, that anxiety would have been a lifesaver. You would have needed it in order to not be eaten by predators, in order to have not put yourself in these dangerous situations. Whereas now, when we're not necessarily, a lot of us luckily aren't in those type of situations every day. So now your body is still wanting to react to these things. And so it's doing it to the email from your boss instead of the tiger in the grass, right? So there are things like that. Like, does that put any relevancy on someone who's having an anxiety disorder or anything like that? No, right? It shouldn't change how you're treated it or anything, but it does actually put it within a framework for us to understand it better. And I think that's helpful. But it can also be used poorly.
The thing is that, you know, there's lots of things make sense, but not everything that makes sense is true. Difficult to sort of shift or sift the true ideas from the ones that are just good.
But I mean, even if you take even just psychology, I mean, that in itself is a field that's really, like, how do you put anything, any kind of label on anything? The DSM-5 or whatever, right? Like, it's essentially, like, how do you draw the line between a narcissistic personality disorder and a borderline personality disorder? Where do you draw that line, right? They can't even. I think as long as you take it within the grain of salt that psychology itself is also should be taken, then I think it's okay.
Yeah. I also made a note that, you know, Darwin never used survival of the fittest, certainly not originally. It was Herbert Spencer that coined that phrase. Yeah. And I think it was used in later editions of The Origin of Species, once it kind of gained currency in the kind of wider cultural world. But that was not something that Darwin coined, and not something that he particularly warmed to, I don't think.
Herbert Spencer was Darwin's cousin? Am I right about that?
I mean, almost everyone from that time period was.
Sure. I think Darwin's wife was also his cousin.
She was, yes.
Herbert Spencer's is he the father of eugenics? Is that the guy? Or am I thinking of somebody else?
You're thinking of somebody else. You're thinking of, what's his name? Who definitely was Darwin's cousin. Galton. Francis Galton.
Galton. That's what I'm thinking of. Sorry.
Yeah, who was Darwin's cousin. But Spencer, right. I think he was just a Victorian sort of polymath scientist, philosopher, bit of everything, you know, the way that those kind of guys with enormous mutton chops were at that time.
Just a professional thinker.
I think he's fairly blameless. I'm just quickly kind of looking through his Wikipedia entry.
If we want to blame people, we've got a lot of people to blame in his list of, in Baba Brinkman's list of evolutionary psychologists here. But so the sort of central theme of this video is based on the research of Martin Daly and Margot Wilson, who he shouts out to in this video. He talks about homicide rates, and he talks about teen pregnancies, and he talks about how these seem like social problems, but really they're an adaptive response in certain social circumstances. And the research essentially says that if you, homicide comes about under certain social circumstances, you have, risky behaviors in humans, and risky behaviors become favorable under certain circumstances because you have to take risks to get rewards. And so that's where we see the homicide rate going up in certain social circumstances. But in the same circumstances, it's going to be the men who are taking risks and, engaging in homicides. In the same situations, the women are going to respond by having births younger, because in a situation where, life is less certain, there's more reward to being riskier, and there's more reward to having your babies earlier. Because if you postpone having babies, then you're going to pass on less genes to the next generation. And this is, again, this is based on the research of Daly and Wilson. And I don't know. Having not read any of their actual research, this feels like a just-so story to me. This feels like one of these, like you said, Ross, it makes sense, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's true.
I think that there are sort of studies where, you look at country by country relative measures of inequality, and then see if there's correlations. But then, correlation's not causation. That's something that we get hammered into us. So certainly it could be the case. And certainly if we find that there's a correlation, then it might be worth putting some effort into reducing inequality, which would then maybe have some effects on things like life expectancy, teenage pregnancy rates, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's very difficult to see whether, is this just a good idea or is this a true idea that's also good?
It just seems to me that, again, having not read any of the studies or looked at any data, there's so many other things that are going to be correlated under the same circumstances, including especially education. And as far as I know, education is a huge factor when it comes to teen pregnancy, which I think probably explains teen pregnancy in, the United States a lot better than homicide rates, right?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think he was saying that homicide rates was the fact of correlation. It was the low economic.
Yeah, the inequality was driving both.
Yeah. A really hard concept to really fully explain well in a 5-minute wrap.
Yeah, and also quite far away from sort of evolution as a science.
Yes.
Or as a hard science that's moving more into the kind of periphery.
Here's the list of all the people he shouts, all of his evolutionary psychology people he shouts out in this song here. He starts with David Buss, who's one of the founders of evolutionary psychology. Cosmides and Tooby, that's Leda Cosmides and John Tooby, who are also considered founders of the field. I think Leda Cosmides was a psychologist and John Tooby was an anthropologist. He shouts out Jeffrey Miller, who I realized in researching this, got into some hot water on Twitter for a tweet he made where he said, "Dear obese PhD applicants, if you didn't have the willpower to stop eating carbs, you won't have the willpower to do a dissertation. Hashtag truth."
I mean, that's gross, really.
Yeah. He shouts out Daly and Wilson, who we just talked about, who are possibly most famous for the Cinderella effect, which is a phenomenon they observed where basically a larger than expected proportion of child abuse comes from step parents. He shouts out Steven Pinker, who is a huge name in especially linguistics. I know I read a ton of Steven Pinker in my linguistics courses, but he's been he's got some not cool ideas about sex and IQ that comes up a lot, I know. he shouts out Robert Wright, who I wouldn't have known except that he wrote a book called The Evolution of God, which I've got on my bookshelf. I remember that being a really interesting book. Although Stephen Jay Gould reviewed it and said that it was pure guesswork as science. Or maybe that was a different book. I think he might have been writing that about the book The Moral Animal. The Evolution of God isn't really science anyway. That's just sort of history. I think Stephen Jay Gould is writing that about The Moral Animal.
I think Pinker's also in the Epstein files as well, which is obviously not great.
Yeah.
Is he?
Yeah. Yeah. Pinker is important for linguistics, but yeah. And then the last guy is David Sloan Wilson, who I think wrote important stuff about group selection at a time when individual or gene selection was more popular. So, yeah, plus a couple of problematic names in there. Plus, Dawkins has said some not great stuff about trans people in recent years. Dawkins kind of had a bit of a fall. Not a great proportion of flawless people in his list of influences.
Yeah, interesting that how time has brought that out.
Yeah.
Should we move on to the next one then?
Yeah, let's move on to the next one. Artificial selection.
I mean, it was okay. I liked the list he had of how people do artificial selection, where they have the choice of seed it, feed it, breed it, or weed it. That was pretty good. And he has some good points made, like the, you know, domestication's not just human. So ants are quite good at it. They have domesticated both aphids and fungi at various points in their kind of evolution. He brings up Malthus, who was a very important figure in the early 19th century, talking about population growth, whose work influenced Darwin pretty significantly. He brings up Lamarckism as well, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, precursor of Darwin in evolutionary thought as well. And then he also makes quite a nice comparison between rat battles and capercaillie lecking, which I don't think I've ever heard before, but does make a lot of sense. It's the same kind of thing. It kind of ties back into his rap as peacocking in the one of the previous videos.
One of the things about this video is that it has a ton of these sort of cards that appear on screen with a photo of an animal and then a description of it. And they fly by so fast that you can't read them unless you pause it, which of course I did for every single one. As part of this, I want to read you one of the most hilarious scientific sentences I've ever read. It's not even a complete sentence because it was a long sentence. So here's a little excerpt for you. This is regarding the bison, right? So there's a photo of a bison, and then the caption says, "The American bison, 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 with two subspecies, the plains bison, 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 and the wood bison, 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 Athabasca."
I don't see what's so funny about that.
This made me think of the sentence. Do you guys know the sentence, buffalo, 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 buffalo?
Yes.
No. Kim's looking confused. Should we explain that sentence or just put a link to people to look up why that's a complete sentence?
Life's too short, yeah.
Okay.
Check the show notes to figure out why buffalo, 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 buffalo is a complete sentence. The cadence and the timing is really important there.
Yeah. You're going to be just as confused at the end, Kim, because it's just, it's bloody Americans.
If it helps you, Kim, the second, third, and seventh buffaloes are capitalized.
Yeah, so I'm guessing it's the buffalo, the town, the city, buffalo wings, buffalo, the animal.
I mean,
buffalo.
No wings.
This buffalo, the verb, which I've never heard outside of the sentence.
Yeah, buffalo, the verb, has never been used except in this sentence, never. Yeah. But there is a verb, buffalo, which means to confuse. So it's about buffalo from the city of Buffalo, who is bison from the city of Buffalo, who confuse other bison who are also from the city of Buffalo, basically. That explains it.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have to be from one small town in the U.S. to get that.
I don't think that anybody from Buffalo would get it any better than anybody else. The other thing is that the caption says for cattle, it says they are called Bos primigenius for domestic cattle.
That's technically correct. In the same way that wolves are Canis lupus. So Bos primigenius is aurochs, which is the wild ancestor of domestic cattle. Domestic cattle also get called Bos taurus, but I think the most technically correct would be Bos primigenius taurus would be the how you describe it. In the same way that with domestic cats, used to be called Felis catus as compared to the wild cat, Felis silvestris, but now we know that domestic cats are descendants of wild cats. Domestic cats are Felis silvestris catus or Felis silvestris libica, because we know what subspecies they came from.
That's interesting. I didn't write it down, but they did show a card for domestic cats, and I'm pretty sure they wrote Felis catus on the domestic cat. Yeah. So, but then the other thing is they go from a bison to domestic cattle, and they don't make a direct connection, but it's like the video is implying the domestic cattle evolved or were domesticated from bison, which is not remotely true.
No, they're not even in the same genus.
They also go to, I have a card for pigs, and they say that pigs were domesticated 13,000 BC in the Tigris River Basin. That's 5,000 years older than any other source I could see.
Yeah.
So I think 13,000 BC, that's 15,000 years ago. That's way too early for the domestication of pigs, isn't it?
Yeah, by probably 5,000 to 3,000 years, my guess.
Yeah,
Ross,
it does sound early. I don't know. I should know, but I don't.
I know. I should know. I'm trying to remember what Joe told me.
Do we want to move on to Darwin's acid?
Yeah, this one kind of pissed me off in ways. So I think with this one, and this is, again, if I understood it, is generally the message with this one was that, like, religion is all fine and dandy, but when you use religion, a lot of times, if you really believe in religion, then it makes it so that you don't care about things as much because, you know, like the climate's dying, but that's okay because God's going to bring the animals back or God's going to fix it. And if it doesn't get fixed, then that was always God's plan. So it kind of just gives us like a way out of just being like, not our problem. God's deciding it or he'll fix it or he'll do it. And that once you understand evolution, you start to see the world. So you start to appreciate the world. You start to see the world. You start to understand nature and it's all beautiful and everything. But then you can also see that it's our responsibility and our destruction and that God's not going to come save us and that we can stop this. So he calls it Darwin's acid. To like drink Darwin's acid kind of takes away that the way that you view the world through the religious perspective, I suppose. But then he makes this comment like where he says that it's up to women, like,
yeah,
if women withhold. It was so fucked up. He's like, if women, so everybody wants sex, and if women stopped having sex with mean people, then mean people would stop being born and then the world would become a better place. So it's up to women. He literally said, like, it's women's responsibility. It's up to us to stop sleeping with mean people. And then mean people would stop being, like, there's so much wrong with that. I don't know where he came up with it.
Well, I think this is the influence of that evolutionary psychology. And I think we can see he's slipping into the biological determinism. So, like, the evolutionary psychology up to this point has been sort of on the fence. But this is where it's like, yeah, this is too deterministic, right?
It's so messed up. Like, one, to assume that someone is either good or bad, and that's all they are, right? That all women are good. And so, like, that's essentially saying that the only mean people in the world are men, and only women, like, all women are good. And then also that sex and reproduction is always consensual. And that sex and reproduction is even when it's consensual to, in a way, it's even within the female power, right? Like, as if all females have a power to decide who we sleep with, who we marry, who we have children with. Like, that's not been the way it's been through all of human history, right?
Yeah.
And just putting that on, it's not up to men to just stop being dickheads, but it's up to women to stop sleeping with them and, like, rewarding it. It was such a messed up view of the world. I was like, what? Yeah. If it had started with this video, I probably wouldn't have watched the other ones.
I mean, it's also weird that in this video, he's talking about how you have to take Darwin's acid to dissolve the idea that there's going to be other, that things will get taken care of by a greater power. Then at the end, oh, and by the way, this is all down to women. You guys can sort it out.
You guys sort it out, yeah. Just stop sleeping with the bad guys. Like, it's just, ugh.
Yeah.
So there is a little kernel of truth in what he's talking about here, because essentially he's talking about different reproductive strategies between males and females, which exists in all animals, all sexually reproducing animals, and it exists in humans. And the idea is that reproductive costs are greater for females than males, because males can have effectively as many offspring as they can find sexual partners, but females are limited to, for humans, one or two offspring every few years. And that evolutionarily leads to different strategies which work well from a natural selection perspective. So for males, there's a greater advantage to being promiscuous. For females, there's a greater advantage to only choosing high quality males. And so there is there's truth to that concept, that is an evolutionary force. But yeah, the way he frames it loses all of that, right? Just to say, what he says is, especially women, on you the pressure is greater. He's talking about evolutionary pressure, but it does just sound like he's saying it's your responsibility, right?
I mean, even if that was true, then how that pressure is responded to as well has to factor into these kind of discussions. So certainly at some point it may have been a winning evolutionary strategy to have lots of kids with multiple partners and then just have no interaction and assume that some of them or enough of them would survive to maturity and have offspring. But that's just one strategy. There are others. So having one or two children with the same partner and then investing time and effort into ensuring that they get like educated on how to survive, how to thrive, how to, you know, you can choose how to invest your effort and how to play your strategy cards essentially. And yeah, one way is to just act as a kind of multi-sperm benefactor. But another is to invest, instead of in lots of low quality offspring, invest in one or two high quality offspring who don't just get your genetic material, but also your cultural material as well.
Yeah. And most primates have that. It's the K versus R strategy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Like rabbits versus primates. And the idea that men are off, like, yes, there is a bit, there is more pressure on women in terms of like, we only get pregnant once every 9 months, whereas men can get multiple women pregnant, but that it's not so tip pointed or imbalanced that his argument makes any remote sense, because it's still, like Ross said, still beneficial for the man, the male, to support the female while she's pregnant from 9 months. If he just fucks off, she might lose the baby and she might die, right? Like, that's why monogamy is such a popular choice among humans and apes, and how, like, it just pissed me off.
There's biological correlates of this as well, right? Because chimpanzees are extremely promiscuous. They don't really have pair bonds, or at least bonobos, right? Everybody has sex with everybody. What happens in this case is, as a male, if everybody's having sex with everybody, one of the ways you can compete is more and higher quality sperm, and as a result, they have huge testicles. And on the other extreme, we'll link some photos of giant chimpanzee testicles in the show notes. At the other extreme, gorillas have a very opposite strategy, where one male controls a harem of females, and so because he's controlling access, he doesn't need to have good quality sperm. Gorillas have tiny little testicles, right?
So small.
Humans are somewhere in between, right? Yeah. So even if we want to look at it from a purely biological standpoint, humans have not evolved to be this extremely promiscuous males, like these sort of biological reductionist arguments want to have us sort of believe, right?
Yeah,
there's a strategy where males will be more successful if they're promiscuous, but there's also strategies where males will be more evolutionarily successful if they invest, if they make a parental investment, right?
So also, like, feedback from this is also maybe it's not all on women to sleep with the good guys, but maybe the good guys could have bigger balls.
That's right.
Did we even mention that the idea that if you don't sleep with mean people, there'll be less mean people in the gene pool hinges on the idea that meanness is genetic, is absolutely not true either, right?
No. And only on the Y chromosome.
Yeah.
Sex linked.
Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, probably problems. The worst one.
It did. I thought it had a good beat though.
It did have a good beat. And the imagery was really nice.
I got to say, at the beginning, it starts with a phylogenetic tree, which is just absolutely
so bad.
A mess. I don't know if you looked at it.
Yeah, I had that.
Humans are more closely related to beavers than gorillas. Dinosaurs are basal somehow to even like trilobites and sharks. It doesn't make any sense.
It had frogs and trilobites on the same branch. I mean,
yeah, frogs and trilobites make a clade. Two more songs here. I don't have a lot of notes for the rest of these. So the next one is Worst Comes to Worst. This one has sort of reggae vibes. I think they ran out of budget by the time they got to this one because it's filmed in front of a really bad green screen. It's just a bunch of people dancing on the beach.
And it's about the Galapagos somehow and how everyone loves Canadians, which is definitely not true.
And then also like what... It's all just like we're all one tribe, essentially. That like he loves
I mean that's quite nice.
He has friends on every continent.
Yeah,
I don't know, this one
reciprocal altruism. That was quite cool. But he I don't know if any of you noticed that he talks about Homo sapiens.
I absolutely that's my only note for this one. I said they ran out of budget and Homo sapiens.
Yeah, but it was also that line that he kept saying, like, we're still going to be Homo sapiens, or we're always going to be, I'm always going to be a Homo sapiens. I'm always going to be a Homo sapiens.
Homo sapien for life.
Yeah, it was so, like, you're like, that's a pointless sentence. It doesn't mean anything. I don't know. It was strange. But he had already soured me at this point. So everything is just, from now on, I'm just annoyed.
Should we move on to the last one, DNA?
Yeah.
Yeah, this one made me uncomfortable too.
I thought this one was bad.
Yeah, I felt again like it was like cultural appropriation.
Yeah, it's got like a Middle Eastern kind of vibe to it.
Yeah, and then naked women, mostly naked women. Yeah. And then the women that are dancing up front, their heads are cut off the entire time. So like they're not even full humans. Their heads, like you don't see their heads. That's just their bodies. I don't know. I have a trouble with that.
Well, they are belly dancers, right?
Yeah, but they're humans.
They have heads though, Josh. They do have heads.
Yes, they have faces.
Ugh. No, it wasn't good. And it didn't actually tell you anything interesting about DNA or evolution.
It tells you that it stands for deoxyribonucleic acid.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you get taught that at 13.
Yeah.
And the refrain says, we are made of DNA, which is something that always bothers me because we're not made of DNA. We're made of proteins. DNA is just the instructions to build those proteins, right?
Yeah, we're not even, there's not all that much deep protein either. It's lots of fats and carbohydrates and DNA is a very, very small percentage of what makes you up. And protein also is quite a small percentage, really.
He shows up Watson and Crick in this one who are... part of the team that are credited with discovering, not Rosalind Franklin, credited with discovering the shape of DNA.
Franklin.
Also, Watson is another one who has sort of fallen in our modern age for...
And also died this past week.
This past week, last year, the November of 2025.
Yeah,
it pissed me off that he didn't mention Franklin, because you're like, if he's supposed to be communicating this stuff to a younger audience, right? Try not to propagate the same mistakes as centuries before. or decades before.
So one of the things about this album is that it was inspired by, I should have looked up the name of the biologist who challenged him to write this album. And it sort of went through a peer review because he sent his first drafts to that guy who reviewed them to sort of check if they were good.
Performance feedback revision.
Performance feedback revision. But I he has performed this this album live at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and off-Broadway. And so he's sort of constantly doing it, constantly tweaking it. I believe there is a revised version of this album, and it might be interesting. I don't think it has videos associated, so it would have to be just music. It would be interesting to take a look at that. I didn't have time to listen to the whole album a second time to see what kind of changes were made, to see if he is sort of continuously updating this over time.
I mean, like, because he soured me at the end, but really, like, I can't write a rap about evolution or a rap about anything. So, like, good on him, right? He did good job. He just, I think he has some problems with women.
Yeah, he gets a participation trophy, but
bearing in mind, was written in 2009-ish. That's a pretty long time ago in terms of our emotional growth as a society. So I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that he cringes a little bit at some of the things in this as well. Although he is still selling t-shirts on his website that say, "Don't sleep with mean people."
Oh, dear. I did like his t-shirt they had in some of the videos, which is quite a famous image of Darwin. I think it says, "Very gradual change we can believe in." I think that's what's on his t-shirt.
I like that. I mean, I do agree with "don't sleep with mean people."
Sure, not for the same reasons.
For eugenics reasons, basically.
No.
And it's not all on us, man.
Yeah,
just because there are different evolutionary reproductive pressures on males versus females doesn't mean that that dictates any of your behavior. You can make choices and you have agency. It might explain why you feel a little bit different than somebody of the opposite sex when it comes to sex, but it doesn't dictate how you should behave in any circumstance, right?
No, yeah. I mean, even when I teach this stuff in undergrad, and there's always a course on, you know, primate mating behavior and such, and you discuss like the monogamy versus the non-monogamy, and then how even with a lot of animals, true monogamy doesn't really exist. Like, there's a lot of cheating that goes like in with humans and with birds, and a lot of animals where they've looked at it, there's a lot of, you know, daddies that aren't from that, from a different nest, right? And I say, like, this, none of this is an excuse. Like, you're still social animals. You're culturally, you live in a culture, and you've made these decisions to be in this relationship. Like, you, it's not an excuse for your behavior.
Yeah.
All right. So we liked a lot of the songs at the beginning of this album. How do we feel overall about the whole concept here?
I give it a C minus.
For effort, I give it a B plus. Like, I think it's good. And I think you can definitely see the money that went into the production, and he did a good job, and he got through some important concepts in a catchy way, but then he goes off track in some things and it gets a bit confusing. And I think he needs to sit down and really have, I know I read online that his wife is a neuroscientist, and I think he needs, so he's obviously not too intimidated by smart, strong women. He needs to sit down and just think about the way that he messages things to young women like this, and young men as well. Just think about the way he sees women in the world and communicates that through his art.
His wife is a neuroscientist. His mother is a member of parliament in Canada. His father owns a tree planting company, I believe. And he, according to his own bios, has planted over 1 million trees in his life in BC, which is pretty cool.
It's a lot of trees.
But yeah, I don't know where I really come down on white people rapping, but it does seem like from that background, I don't know, man.
Yeah.
Well, Happy New Year, everybody. This is our first episode of 2026. Thanks for continuing to listen to the podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, why don't you give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or a review, or leave us a comment on YouTube or Spotify or anywhere else you can do that.
Happy New Year!
Oh, God. Can't believe it's nearly December.
Do you have questions, comments, or movie requests? We want to hear from you. Find us on Blue Sky and Facebook at SOTSA Podcast. Send us an email to screensofthestoneage@gmail.com or visit our website at screensofthestoneage.com.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.